Everybody, this is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. David Steinberg is back. David, and this is a quote on a blurb from his book that we last spoke about, this thing we call sex. And it's so true. I've known David for 30-plus years. David Steinberg is simultaneously a thoughtful observer and a participant, an explorer with empathy, a writer with honesty. That is so true. And this time we're going to talk about his soon-to-be-published The Shepherd and the Nymph, the erotic letters of Marco Vossi and Eve Diana. Welcome back to this program, David. I'm so glad you're here. Hello.
Thank you, Diana. Good to be talking with you.
Thank you. So, you have, because we spoke about Marco Vossi. Vossi, am I pronouncing his last name right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. We spoke about him, actually, in a show that we did February 27th, 2018, last year. And we spoke a little bit about him then, and you were, and I gather still are, working on a screenplay about his life. But you got a little bit redirected. Can you talk about that? And then I want to ask you about a little more about Marco Vossi and why he's important. But how did you go from the screenplay is a little bit on the side right now, as you have other things to do.
Yeah, I'm actually working on three different projects related to Marco Vossi. Marco was a sexual explorer, sort of a sexual philosopher, and certainly a sexual writer in the 70s and 80s. Recognized by all sorts of people, Norman Mailer and Maurice Gerodius and so on, as the best of the erotic writers of that time. And when I was introduced to his work way back then, I was fascinated with him. He died in 1989. He'd been diagnosed HIV positive about a year before and was seriously depressed about that and essentially committed suicide by catching pneumonia and holding himself up where nobody could find him for a while. But I've recently been reviving his memory in three different projects. I've been working for over a year now on a screenplay, which is not a documentary, but a drama based on his life and those times when of the sexual revolution, mostly in New York. The movie mostly takes place in New York. All the exuberance of all the sexual possibilities of the 70s and 80s running smack dab into the AIDS crisis of the 80s. Mm-hmm. I've also been working on collecting a thorough archive of his writings to preserve those. And for a long time, I've been wanting to publish a book of the letters that he and one of his lovers, a woman, a younger woman that he had a relationship with for about 8 months, Eve Diana, that they had shortly before he was diagnosed with HIV in 1986 and 87. Mm-hmm. So I've been working on the screenplay for about a year mostly, mm-hmm. but right now the book has finally fallen together, and so that's kind of being my main focus. I think it's an extraordinary book, and we're in the process of doing final editing and book design, and it will come out either later this fall or sometime in the winter.
Great, great. And you sent me a link, and I've been reading through it, and it's really great. It's a good story, but it's also great erotica. The writing is such a turn-on. I mean, people could read this and self-pleasure and because these were personal letters between the two of them, Marco and I guess she was called Diana, And you said to me they never thought that this would they would be published. So it's a real kind of insight. It's a window into their very personal relationship, and it's very explicit and very erotic and quite a turn-on, I must say.
Yeah, I think that's definitely one aspect of the book. When I first showed the manuscript to Marco's literary agent, who I hadn't been in touch with for decades, he was very excited about it. He called it an erotic masterpiece, and I you know I think that that's true. One of the things about Marco was that he was always looking at what he was doing, at what he was involved in of his sexual activities and whatever, with a very keen eye. So in the process of he and Eve writing back and forth to each other, Marco was living in New York at that time, and Eve was living in Boston, and they would travel back and forth to get together, but in between times they would be writing each other. And you know, yes, in one sense I think it's hot writing, because they were just two people who were very open to sexual exploration, and that was a good part of what they were doing. And you know, I think Marco is an astounding writer, and Eve in her own right is quite a writer as well, and
yes,
also quite a keen observer of the dynamics of their relationship and what was going on. You know, some of it which was exciting and fun, and a lot of it was difficult and conflicted. Marco was 20 years older than her. They came from different backgrounds. They had different ideas of what they wanted from life. They, early on in their relationship, were aware of the limits of where they could go with this. They kind of wished and hoped and tried to believe that they could, that this could be a, you know, a long-standing primary relationship, but I think that they were both aware that that was in many ways unlikely, and they had lots of fights and conflicts. Marco, on one hand, was, as I say, a brilliant observer and a brilliant writer. At the same time, he was not above sort of simple-minded fits of jealousy and whatnot. I've always been intrigued with him because he was both what I like to call a master and a goat. He was, you know, he was wonderful and he was infuriating, alternatingly or at the same time. And one of the things that I like about this book, for all the people who are interested in Marco, and he had quite a following at the time that he was writing. He wrote 13 novels and hundreds of articles during the time he was alive, many of which were autobiographical, but none of which, in my opinion, revealed him with such utter honesty as these letters, which, as you said, were not written with the intent of being published. They were written as documents for each other. And I've been sitting on this book for 30 years trying to pull it, to get the rights and the ability to pull it all together. And now that it's finally actually happening, it's very exciting to me.
So it is exciting, and I want to know about how you crossed over some of the barriers, like getting permission from his Marco's son and so on. But tell us a little bit more about who was, I mean, we've said some, but who was Marco Vassi and why is he important? And what are his most important books? Let's focus on the main character here, for a bit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Marco, he was born in 1937 in Italian East Harlem, which was, you know, an Italian ghetto run by the mafia. Marco writes about his childhood, that this was a place that had no crime whatsoever. It was like an old Italian village, because nobody was going to go up there and mess with the mafia. So it was
right.
You know, an amazing place to grow up, very provincial. Catholic Italian, and he joined the Air Force in the 50s when he was 19 years old, went overseas, was first sexual with sex workers, actually, in Japan, and then came back to the United States in the early, well, in the late 60s, mid-60s, in the middle of the, and went back to New York and was involved in sort of literary and sexual circles that were evolving in New York. He was involved with a group called Theater of the Encounter that was doing radical theater work involving people like Sam Shepard and Al Pacino. In fact, Marco Al Pacino got his start as an actor in a play that Marco wrote called Why Is a Crooked Letter that examined non-monogamy and jealousy, a two-person play, and Al Pacino was nominated for an Obie Award for that, and then that kind of, you know, got him some recognition as an up-and-coming actor. And anyway, there was this whole theater circuit in New York that was doing all kinds of interesting things. And then Marco got involved with what at that time were sort of the more cutting-edge porn magazines, like, well, Penthouse had a spin-off called Penthouse Forum, and and then Marco started another Penthouse spin-off called Variations that was an attempt at using the porn marketplace to do some serious educational work as well as, you know, titillating people with all kinds of tales. And Marco started that, and Variations then got built up into quite a successful magazine. I think it had a circulation of over a million while it was at its heyday. So he wrote hundreds of articles. At one point, he saw an ad in the Village Voice for some porn producer that was looking for new material, and he answered the ad. He wrote a short novel and sent it in, and the publishers wrote back and said, "Oh, this is way too literary for us."
Really?
And sorry, and good luck. But Marco got in touch with an up-and-coming literary agent at that time, Richard Curtis, who was in touch with Maurice Herodias. Now, Maurice Herodias ran a publishing outfit called the Olympia Press that was doing cutting-edge erotic work. They published Henry Miller for the first time in the U.S. and, you know, did all kinds of work that was challenging all the obscenity laws at that time. And Maurice took one look at Marco's novel and loved it, bought it, immediately commissioned him to write three more novels for Olympia Press, and that was kind of how Marco broke into the literary scene. He went on to write, like as I said, 13 novels and a number of collections of both short fiction and essays about sexuality. The best, I think. I mean, if you want to talk, you know, his leading books. There's one of his books is called The Erotic Comedies, and is a collection of short stories and essays. It was published by Martin Shepard and what's the name of his the Permanent Press. Great collection. I think his best known book is The Stoned Apocalypse, which is an autobiographical kind of travelogue of his erotic travelings when he came out to California in the mid 70s. And I guess the novels that he's best known for are two of his early novels, Mind Blower and The Gentle Degenerates, which both explore, in one sense, they're just sexy writing, but at the same time, they explore all kinds of issue, even philosophical issues about what is sexuality and what goes on in sexual relationships and power dynamics and spiritual elements and so on. And because for Marco, sexuality was more than just having a good time. It was also a way of getting down into the heart, really, of the, you know, the main questions about what is life all about and what does it mean to be alive.
You know, David, this also describes you to a degree.
Well, you know,
I mean, you, you know, because it, you
in
just,
a way,
yeah. And so, you must have looked at him as kind of a pioneer in this area. I'm looking at this is on your website, by the way, listeners. His website is davidsteinberg.us. But so there are lots of blurbs on that book that say this. I mean, like David Steinberg's ability to write clearly and honestly about what he feels and observes is a gift. He gives us stark, naked truth, rational philosophy, cultural history, and erotic wisdom. And you do all of that so well. I've known you now for over 30 years, and just he, in some ways, was he like an example for you of I mean, I know you're your own person, but
I think that, you know, I think that that's mm-hmm. that's certainly true. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm a different person than Marco. I don't have the demons of Italian Catholicism hanging around my neck,
yeah.
You know.
For starters.
On the other hand, Marco had writing skills, personal
mm-hmm.
skills that you know, I would be happy to have half of. So, but I think the way that Marco worked for me, or and Henry Miller and other people, you know, was. People show that it's possible to look at sexuality in a different way than the normal ways that we're told to look at sexuality by the society. And every time we come across somebody who says, hey, you might think about looking at it like this, it's not like mm-hmm. we have to adopt their viewpoint, but what we do adopt is the possibility of thinking about all these issues in less trivial ways. That's how I see it. And so, in one sense, yeah, Marco does set an example for that. And I, you know, I do what I can with that. I do it through my writing and through my photography. And I know that people who have read stuff that I've written and seen photography that I've done have similarly, you know, been inspired. It's like, oh, maybe I'll try doing something like that. And you know, that's always gratifying, you know, of all the things to think about, how you can be useful in the world if you're inspiring other people to do their own creative work, which then goes out and inspires a whole other circle of people to think about things in a different way. You know, you can't get much better than that in my book. So yeah, you know,
because,
it's not,
you
like
know,
I'm sitting around trying to imitate mm-hmm. Marco Vasi, but he certainly showed ways of thinking and ways of looking at sexuality that, you know, helped me to develop my own sense of what those issues were all about.
Yes, and you know, I think a lot of people want to have more meaning in their lives. And certainly, being inspired about sex and deepening one's sexual relationships through reading, perhaps Vasi's work, your work for sure, I'm real familiar with your work, this can be helpful for having more self-awareness about one's sexuality and also being an explorer and an adventurer. This is exciting.
Yeah, well, that, you know, that's certainly how Marco saw himself. You know, his birth name was Ferdinand, and he went by Fred as a kid. But mm-hmm. Somewhere along the way, he adopted the name Marco because he identified so strongly with Marco Polo.
Mm-hmm.
So Marco Polo was himself, you know, an Italian explorer. He explored
mm-hmm.
went to China. He explored worlds that the people back home knew nothing about, and he brought back to them you know, wonders for them to know about and think about and pursue if they wanted beyond their wildest conventional dreams. And Marco saw himself very much that was his job. His job was to go out.
His job.
Explore the frontiers. Of course, he did it because it was exciting, and he was having a grand old time, and so on. But he very much knew that what he wanted to do was to bring back word, you know, news from the frontier. Here's what's going on in places that you yourself may not choose to visit, but let me tell you about it. And to make what he discovered out there on the edge available to other people and useful to other people in terms of their own development. In fact, that was a big part of his depression when he was diagnosed with HIV. Marco felt like he had made a deal with God, and the deal was that he would do God's work. He would go out and do this exploration for the benefit of mankind, humankind, for the benefit of the people back home. And in return, God would protect him from the dangers of such crazy travels, like he protected Marco Polo from getting killed on the road. So, and Marco felt like as long as he stayed true to his purpose, he was being watched out for. Marco's theology is complicated. It's not. He was in and out. You know, he wasn't a churchgoer by any means. But Catholicism was very deeply in his bones, for better and for worse, in my opinion.
Yeah, as it often is. I mean, I witnessed that in many of my clients over the last 35 years.
So when he was diagnosed with AIDS, he was like stunned. In one sense, he had done so many wild, crazy things. He had gone to the baths in New York and had sex, you know, receptive anal intercourse with 20 guys in a night. And, you know, he talked about having had sex with 1,000 men and 500 women during the course of his life. So in one sense, you could say, well, it's not exactly surprising that he contracted AIDS. But for him, he was like shocked. Like, how can this be happening to me, Marco Vasi? Because he writes about this in the diary that he kept during the time after he was diagnosed. He said, I kept my end of the bargain, you know. I did what I was supposed to do, and now you're letting me down. How can this possibly be happening to me? And he never really made his peace with that, which is why he ended up committing suicide.
Mm-hmm. What a complex and fascinating story this is. So let us know a little bit more about Eve Diana. What was the nature of their relationship, and what was she like? You sent me the link, and I've read perhaps as much as the first third of the book, so I have a sense of it. But I'd like you to fill our listeners in on who she was.
Other than
being somebody 20 years younger than he was.
Yeah, she was. They met through mutual friends. I think they met through Annie Sprinkle, whom they both knew. Eve was, I'm not going to get this right, maybe 27 or 28. Marco was 48 when they met, and already, you know, established as, I mean, for people in the erotic world, you know, well-known as a writer. So for Eve, it was sort of a she was getting to be with the great Marco Vasi. She was getting to be with a celebrity. But Eve, you know, Eve herself was quite a sexual explorer, and you know, in touch with her own sexual spirit. I met her shortly after Marco died through a mutual friend of ours, and I was just struck by her immediately. So when she and Marco got together, sparks flew. Marco was attracted to her, intrigued with her, and she was, in one sense, thrilled to have his attention. On the other hand, she really was a strong woman, and it wasn't like she was just kind of blown over by him. So things well, they kind of took off between them pretty quickly. They did a lot of sexual exploring. What they ran up against pretty quickly was a dark side two dark sides of Marco's personality. One was Marco was prone to being insanely jealous, for somebody who had been around the had written about how monogamy was a perversion and, who was into exploring sexuality in all its dimensions. It was ludicrous that he would get insanely jealous just because of the way Eve would be dancing with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Eve was involved. Yeah. It was a dance. It was involved with the whole dance community in New England, and they would go to a dance, and Eve would be dancing in a sexy way with some guy, and Marco would flip out, and Eve would have to deal with that, and that kept on coming up over and over again, and. I mean, the way it is with Marco is he will write about it and he will say, look, I know this is totally ludicrous that I am feeling so jealous. However, I am, and he would try to say, all right, I don't want to restrict what you do. I don't want to restrict who you are. You do it and I'll deal with my feelings. And then she would, and he wouldn't be able to deal with his feelings, and they would go around and around and around about it. And that was kind of a ongoing thing, which in some ways, I know that the relationship was doomed to end in any case, but that was one of the issues around which they decided to stop seeing each other. And the other one is that Marco went through his whole life in a state of gloom. All the people who knew him, it wasn't just like he was this happy warrior. He could write about all this stuff. He could have all these amazing adventures, and yet, at the end of the day, he would kept on coming back to this place of none of this means anything. He just wasn't what you'd call a happy person, and so they also, they had to deal with that. Marco's notion was, well, if we're going to have a relationship, immediately the question is, are we going to get married? Because what I really want is a woman who will be there for me, whenever I want to have my traditional Italian wife home waiting for me when I get home from the office. And he would know that that was ludicrous, but he also knew that in his gut, that's what he was looking for if he was going to be in a permanent or long-term relationship. It's part of why he never was in a permanent or long-term relationship in his life. He was married four times. He went from one relationship to another, so that was what he was all about. And Eve, I think, experienced the good parts and the bad parts. He would drive her crazy with his inconsistencies and his contradictions. And at the same time, he would bring to their connection his amazing ability to be present in the moment and to make the person he's with feel like they were the most important person in the world to him. Not only feel like it, but be the most important person in the world. That was one of Marco's one of the most powerful things about him. When Marco was with you, he was with you 100%, and this was the most important thing that was happening in the universe. And being the recipient of that kind of attention is pretty tricky, because it's then you think, I am the person meant for him, So,
and yet, as I read through some of the book from the link you sent me, I was impressed that even though she was pretty young, late 20s, I think she felt pretty good about herself. And women that feel good about themselves tend to feel better about sex. And she had a certain sense of adventure. She wouldn't have been able to get together with him if she hadn't, Do you think that that's some of it in terms of Eve, Diana?
Oh, yeah. No, it is. It, mm-hmm. You know, she definitely was there. But, you know, we're working now. She's writing sort of an afterword to the book, like, you know, looking back from 30 years later. And and she talks about it. What was difficult for her was this notion that, you know, was she really special, or was she just the latest of Marco's connections? You know, and she knew that she knew so many of the women that Marco had been had important relationships with before her. So she knew, you know, that he has been down maybe not this road, but a similar road dozens mm-hmm. of times before. Mm-hmm. And then when they split up, and he didn't follow up with a lot of connection with her, he did a horrible thing when he was diagnosed HIV positive. He didn't tell her.
And he should have had a responsibility to do that.
Sure. I mean, she could easily have had HIV herself.
Right.
And she only found out through the network eventually, and then she got tested four times. She kept on testing negative, and she couldn't quite believe that she could possibly be negative. So she had to be tested like three times until the doctors told her, "Look, you don't have HIV. You know, believe it." But of course, though, you know that, and so of course, she's 30 years later. She's still angry about that, and properly so.
Mm-hmm.
But what she writes about in her afterword is that there is that. But in some sense, the biggest issue for her is she feels like in the end, she was one more person that Marco had a powerful connection with in the course of her life, and she, you know, she's had to deal with the consequences of that. Now, you know, as she writes, she after she and Marco split up, she didn't sit around moping about it, you know, and she said, if you ask me now, is Marco the most important relationship or sexual relationship in my life? She would say no. She said, you know, she went on, she got married, she's still married, she has a son who's graduated college last year, you know, I mean, she's gone on and put a life of more depth than an eight-month affair with Marco Vasi, you know, that in the end has much more meaning to her than that. So, you know, it's not like she's this poor young thing that Marco had this neat time with and then sat around and grieved about it for the rest of her life. She's, you know, she's a much stronger person than that. But, you know, but she's still dealing with the aftermath of it. As far, you know, I have, in the course of knowing Marco and the whole network that he was part of, I've talked with so many people who were lovers of his. And my friend Andrea Ossip, who was, I guess she was in a sort of primary relationship with Marco for about a year. And then when I met her, which was right after he died, it was maybe 10 years after that. And she told me that, you know, 10 years later, and then I knew her for another 10 years before she died, she said, a single day does not go by when I don't think about Marco. So, you know, he was a person that when he came through your life, he changed you. He changed you, I think, in a lot of ways for the better, but in a lot of ways that can be really difficult. And all of that develops in the course of this book. And one of the things that I think is so fascinating about this book is you just get to watch all of this happening, you know, like you're in the same room, because the two of them, Marco was obsessed with chronicling his whole life. I mean, that's what he did all the time. So when mm-hmm. they would go off to the Hamptons for a week, next thing happens is Marco writes Eve a 35-page letter detailing everything that they did during the course of that week. The emotion, not only specifically, you know, what they did sexually, but the emotions of it and what was when they were on with each other, when they were off with each other, why they were off with each other, what was going on, all this kind of stuff. And then Eve responded with like a 20-page letter of her own going over the same material from her point of view. So so the book is full of them, you know, detailing to each other what whatever they had just done together. So you get to be like you're in the same room with them. And that's how I feel about it. And if that sort of complexity interests you, and if that kind of sexual exploration interests you, or if Marco Vasi as a particular, you know, person interests you, this book is just loaded with good stuff.
Yes, and the third of the book that I did have time to read, and I plan once, well, I'm going to read the rest of it online, I mean on my computer, but I also really want to buy the book when it's published, because it's such great erotic writing. I mean, it can be so stimulating for self-pleasuring, for example. But there were also philosophical things, like she says in the part that I, to choose not to merge with anyone for fear of losing myself. And that's in my long time being a psychotherapist, that's a very common, it's kind of Freudian, but to merge with somebody, the fear of that I'll be swallowed up, lose some of myself. And she had enough awareness to say that. And then she also said that she prayed to Diana, and of course I paid attention to this.
Yeah, sure.
My own name. My chosen deity, goddess of the moon, the hunt, and virgins. And then there was a little an asterisk about her own therapist. The only thing we can give one another is time. All of that resonated for me. All of these psychological, philosophical insights, ideas that were written in these letters. I loved what I read, and I plan on, when I have a little more time, going back and reading it more.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear it. I mean, you know, I want to do this book in part to keep Marco's existence, Marco's memory alive.
Yes.
And I think for anybody who cares about who he was, this book offers insight into him that, you know, even through him having written so many other things, it provides another level that's not available elsewhere. But I really think that it for somebody who doesn't care about Marco Vasi, this book is also valuable, or can be valuable. My partner Kim Mears, who I've been with for 13 years,
yes,
has been frustrating to me. You know, we laugh about this together because I'm all involved with Marco this way, that way, and the other way. And Kim says, yeah, Marco Vasi. I mean, I don't care about him. I don't understand why he, I sort of understand, but I don't really understand why he's so important to you. And, you know, so it's like, okay, you go do your Marco thing, and when you're done doing your Marco thing, come back and let's have a nice weekend. And I guess at some point I gave her the latest version of the manuscript. I think we had just designed the cover, and I was happy about mm-hmm. that. And so she picked it up just like, well, she glanced at it, basically. And she said she couldn't put it down. I think, where was I? I was out of town or something. And she wrote me a note and said, I've been reading the Eve Marco letters, and they're amazing. And that she said that when she was a third of the way through it, and she said that when she was two-thirds of the way through it, and she said that when she had read the whole book. And that was Kim is just one person, but I was really encouraging to me, because here was a person who did not start out being intrigued with Marco. If anything, she was like, don't bother telling me about Marco. I've already heard more about Marco than I want to know. And yet, the book grabbed her and you know, in a powerful way.
And turned her on.
Yeah, and turned, yes, yeah.
The erotic
it
writing.
Turned her on, but, and it was interesting, you know, it was raising interesting questions and talking about interesting stuff. So that says to me that the book has a potential audience of people
mm-hmm.
like Kim who are, you know, sexually open-minded and would be interested in hearing the story. So
It's a wonderful story, and this book, I think, will be really, well, I don't know if you have maybe a bestseller, but the marketing is difficult, isn't it, for something like this?
Yeah, I think it, you know, I've published other books. I've been publishing books for a while, but
yes,
you know, my publishing company, it's just me, and
mm-hmm.
we don't have a lot of money behind us. I'm hoping that somehow the book will get seen or reviewed or somewhere
mm-hmm.
in
mm-hmm.
some networks where people who will appreciate it for what it uniquely has to offer
mm-hmm.
will write something saying, hey, this book is really amazing, and, you know, and the word will spread. I don't know if through blogs or through the various networks that now exist. So I'm going to do my best to, you know, to generate interest in it, and at least to have people get a chance to see what's there, and hopefully it will find its way to people that'll find it useful.
And I hope that this program will inspire people to check it out.
Definitely, definitely.
And they, your website is very informative and inspiring, and that is davidsteinberg.us. And
I want to mention that there is a website,
yes.
Although there's not a whole lot of Aussie stuff on my website. But if people are listening and are into Facebook at all, there is a Marco Vassi
mm-hmm.
sort of memorial page. If you
mm-hmm.
go to Facebook and you search for Marco Vassi, you'll find it. It's a group. It's a membership group, but it's a group that's open to anybody. So posted there is a lot of stuff that I've posted over the last year or two related
mm-hmm.
to Marco. So if anybody is interested, two things. They can contact me through my website, or, you know, email david@davidsteinberg.us. That's all on the website. Or through the Marco Vassi Facebook page. People can post comments there and set up a connection. If people want to know about this book when it comes out and get on a mailing list to be informed of it, that sort of thing, that would be the best way to do that.
Terrific. So let's circle back to your getting permission, so to speak, to go ahead with this book with the letters. You had to search out Marco's son, and that's an interesting story. We spoke about it off the air. So what happened about that, and tell us.
Yeah, well, you know, when once we had a manuscript that we could work with, Eve was delighted to have me publish the book or find a publisher for the book. And
mm-hmm.
The problem was that the rights to Marco's letters had been left to Marco's son in his will,
mm-hmm.
Marco's will. And his son is a guy with a really common name.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent 6 months trying to track this person down to no avail. And in fact, we were pretty much going to give up on the whole thing because of that. And then by chance, Andrea Ossoff, the woman I mentioned who had a relationship with Marco, I was working with her son about developing an archive of Marco's writings and original copies of his manuscripts and stuff like that. And her son, I was saying that I had this amazing book And I didn't know what to do with it because I couldn't find Marco's son. Nobody knew where Marco's son was. And he said, I know where Marco's son is. I talked to him last week. I said, what?
Ta-da! Wow.
Yeah, it was like, I mean, it was just like I couldn't believe it. And sure enough, he put me in touch with Eric. His name is Eric Johnson. And Eric and I got together, and he is a delightful young man in mid-40s and not at all at odds with who his dad was and all the sexual mm-hmm. stuff. And when I explained, you know, the book and our intentions with the book, he said, great, go for it. So, you know, we even Eric contracted with me to be the publisher of the book, and now it's finally happening.
You've had to have some patience, and you've got.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah. You've had passion about this project, as I think you do, David, because, you know, I've known you over 30 years. You have passion about things that you engage with, and that's part of your charm and part of your success, I think, that you're so authentic and so sex positive and you're an observer, explorer, and a participant in a lot of, like you, with your photography, you get to be a participant in other people's sex lives. Let's just for people that haven't heard our past shows, touch on that a little bit with your, and then we'll come back to the book. But what you do with your photography and couples and photographing their intimate moments.
Yeah, sure. I mean, my entry into this whole, for 15 years, I wrote a column for Spectator magazine called Comes Naturally, a monthly column
mm-hmm.
about sex and gender issues. And I wrote like over 150 columns over 15 years and developed, you know, a readership through that. Not so much really through Spectator, but then through the internet as the internet developed over time. And
yes.
And then I got involved in doing what I call fine art sexual photography, of photographing in a fine art way, in with black and white photography of couples, regular people like you and me being sexual at home, with the notion that, you know, if we have a critique of pornography for its peculiar twists and turns, then what would real photography about sex look like, or photography around real sex look like? And that's a complicated issue because sex is generally very private. But so my goal has been to get people to allow me into the private space of their sexuality in a way
yes.
that they can really get down in the way that they do when nobody's around with a camera in their hand, and capture some of that intimacy on film. And you know, over the last 20 years, I've done just under 200 couples. So I've had the opportunity to photograph all sorts of people, ages 19 to 75, of all different backgrounds, sexual preferences, sexual orientations, body types, whatever. Being sexual in whatever, however they're sexual. And I've been able to get, I think, some pretty amazing photos just because...
Yes, you have.
When people are not self-conscious and just get to be themselves, you can get some, you know, they're in a really beautiful place, and if you're there with them, it's really not that hard to get it down on film. So... You know, so I'm that's another project as soon as I get around, you know, is to put together a book of those photographs, which, you know, I think will reach out to people about sexuality in a whole different way.
I think so. And you just used the word film, and I know, because actually my husband and I watched one of your sessions when you were here in Seattle, and... You use real film. You don't use digital. And tell us about that.
Oh, I don't know. I'm lazy. film is what I know, and you know, my good friend Michael Rosen, who is a brilliant, also really a brilliant fine arts sexual photographer, converted mm-hmm. from film to digital, and I watched him take 2 years out of his life learning how to do that really well, and mm-hmm. I just did not want to stop doing the creative part in order to do the technical part for
two years.
So I just haven't done it, and there are lots of advantages about working digitally, but there's something rewarding about film also. So I've stuck with film, and as long as I can still get film, and I can still get film cameras, which is a little tricky these days. the work that I do is very low tech. I work with a 35 millimeter camera and some simple lights. I don't do anything fancy or with a lot of technological bells and whistles. But I try to keep it simple so as to focus on the content. Which is what is going on emotionally between these two people, or sometimes three people, whatever. In the course of being sexual with each other.
And that is one reason, David, you've been very successful at this, because you relate to these couples and they feel like they can trust you, that you won't take advantage of their private, intimate moments. And that, you know, kudos to you for doing that, because there are very few people that could do this, that could get the kind of results that you get.
Well, to me, that is the whole thing. I mean, mm-hmm. you have to believe that you're not being weird with them, that mm-hmm. you are not going to twist who they are in some kind of a way. And I do that by, everything I do is designed to make people feel comfortable with me, comfortable with the situation.
Mm-hmm.
I photograph people in their homes because I think that's where people feel most comfortable. I don't direct people. I don't tell them, do this, do that, or, oh, stop, could you just do that again? I try not to interrupt their flow in any way that I don't need to. So I think there are other photographers who are more skilled at the craft of photography than I am, but I think the way that I work with people, keeping it spontaneous and not directing and not doing it in studio or anything like that, produces a certain kind of spontaneity that I think is different from the work that other people are doing. So that, you know, I feel like that's my contribution to the field, if you will. And it's also what I like. There are a lot of artists who want to be totally in control of the situation and manage the light just perfectly, manage the action just perfectly or whatever. To me, I just love that it's kind of out of control, that if the couple rolls over and now they're on the other side of the bed and I've got to move my lights over to the other side of the bed, and by the time I get there, I've missed the whole thing and blah, 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 that there's this kind of chaotic nature of a photo shoot, which to me seems appropriate to sexuality, because sex in part is some of the wonderful stuff about sex is about going out of control, of not being so tightly in control all the time of your emotions or your energies and
exactly
going to happen. So when we go on a shoot, there, you know, who knows what's going to happen, and it's, to me, it's a little bit of I don't want to get pretentious about it, but it's kind of a little bit like a shamanic journey. The couple mm-hmm. and I enter into this little world where the three of us are sitting in it together, and amazing stuff happens. Often stuff happens for them that beyond what usually happens for them when they're by themselves. So there's a kind of magic that takes place that I don't even know how to describe. There are pictures that happen because when I hit the button to take a picture, the camera malfunctions, but then a second later, it takes a better picture than the picture that I was intending to take. I mean, there's really weird stuff that goes on. And I just love it. It's just like, okay, we're now on this wild ride, and we're going to take it together because we are comfortable with each other. We trust each other, the three of us, and we'll see what we get at the other end. And, you know, I would say out of the 200 shoots I've done, in all but one or two shoots that went wrong for extraneous reasons, the couples are just amazed and thrilled with the pictures that they end up with at the end, which is what I tell them. I said, this is the only way you will get to see what you look like when you are in the middle of being sexual. It's not the same as looking in the mirror. You need to be where you're not paying attention to that, and somebody is around who can see the important moment and capture it on film.
Well, you know, you have established a relationship with your couple that you're photographing, where they feel safe and they trust you. And, you know, that's the basis for all intimate relationships. And you're obviously not sexually intimate with these people, but it is intimate because it's emotionally intimate.
Yes.
And so you capture these wonderful images. And these images have won you prizes at the Seattle Erotic Arts Festival, SEAF.
Yes.
Where some of your photographs have been given awards.
Yeah, they named me one of their Masters of Erotic Art, which was exciting and an honor. And the Leydig Foundation in London proclaimed me Erotic Photographer of the Year. I think it was 2014. So you know, I started all this just as a kind of an experiment, and then it kind of took off, and people appreciated what I was doing, so I was glad to keep doing it.
So we are about to end the program, so I before the music sets in, I want to just thank you again for returning. There's always so much we can talk about, and I just so appreciate you, David, and all that you do, and I look forward to getting your book, and I'm suggesting to the listeners of this program, and it'll be archived by tomorrow morning, that there's the music. So go check out David Steinberg. Thank you, David.
Thank you so much, Diana. Good talking with you.
You too. Bye, everybody.
E se ti perderai nel labirinto di un amaro autore.
Ma i tuoi piedi, ta 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 ta. Ma i tuoi piedi, ta 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 ta. Oh, happy feet, ta ta ta, happy feet, ta ta ta, happy feet.